This is Wheel Bearings, episode 457. I am Sam Abuel-Samad from Telemetry.
And I am Roberto Balder from SAE International.
And Nicole is absent somewhere, and I'm not entirely sure where. By the time she's ready to join us again in a couple of days, I will be busy. So we decided to just go ahead and do this ourselves.
Yeah.
So, Robbie, you been driving anything?
I've been driving a lot of things. I drove the EV9 across, Nebraska?
Nebraska, Wyoming, and into Utah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and then I drove the Cadillac Escalade IQ across Wyoming and, and Utah. You're not very long in Utah, but in Utah.
Yeah.
And then,
well, I guess the EV9 was just Nebraska and Wyoming, and then
yeah,
you
it's
got
just
into
a very yeah, it's just a very yeah, it's because Nebraska is so wide.
Or was yeah, yeah,
it's incredibly wide. It just kept driving, and it never felt like we ever left Nebraska. As far as I can tell, I'm still in Nebraska.
And you could plop down pretty much anywhere along that route in Nebraska, and not really be able to just look around and distinguish where you are, unless you happen to be in some town that had a sign.
It's pretty flat. Like, yes. There's a tree, and you can see it from one side of the state to the other, which is unnerving for me because I've always lived in California, except for the short, stint I lived in Kansas City, which also didn't have any mountains, which made me anxious. I'm always used to seeing something off in the distance, either the mountains or the ocean or something, even hills in Nebraska. I saw, like, a few kind of hills, so, but, yeah. Yeah, the people at the gas stations were very nice, though. But they were very nice because I was very nice to them, and they seemed very surprised by that. I guess people aren't nice to people when they're driving along the 80 from coast to coast. They're just like, ugh.
Well, I mean, we actually encountered a lot of people on our charging stops. So we're talking about Operation Frodo, which we did this past week, and at the stops where we paused to charge up the EVs that we were driving and walk the dogs, let them out, get a little fresh air. We actually had a surprising number of people come up and say hello and ask what's going on and want to learn more about what we were doing, why we were transporting all these dogs. And so it was kind of fun. What the funniest thing was, our very last scheduled stop in Stanfield, Oregon on Wednesday. So we, at that point, we're about 185, 186 miles from our destination in Portland. While we were there charging and walking the dogs, this guy walks up to us and says, "Hey, are you the crew from Operation Frodo?" And he said he's been following us on social media for the last 3 days and
oh, wow.
Was really excited to meet us. So that was fun.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
So during that time, I drove those cars. And excuse me, I'm burping. Sorry. I just took a big swig of Red Bull. And I'm full of lightly carbonated, liquid cocaine, whatever Red Bull's made out of. Yeah, so I'd driven the EV9 before. I had not driven the Escalade IQ. Which is so we didn't have to charge it as much as the other vehicles, but that's because it has a gigantic battery and it really was like driving a boat. So yeah, so that was it's so big, it's just like, but it's it's an Escalade,
but it's a very fast, really big boat.
Yeah, it's a very fast, very big boat. There's lots of room in it. We put a lot of dogs in there. We were able to get 4 crates and 3 people in that car during our drive, because I was with Nick and with Robert, who is a videographer and photographer. And Nick had to do some video shoot stuff, and then they had to shoot video of me saying stuff, which I don't know where that went. I guess I should look that up.
I don't know if that's
they did an interview
yet
with me. I don't know where it's at.
Yeah.
But this past week I got back and I got a Subaru Crosstrek, the hybrid version. It has 194 horsepower. It doesn't say Oh, I'm not really ready today, to be honest. I didn't have, I haven't had a chance to do like a lot of testing with this vehicle, so I haven't done a loop or anything. But according to the EPA, it gets 36 miles per gallon, regardless of what it's doing. It's 36, 36, 36. it has a 2.5 liter.
Well, I mean, that's not atypical for hybrids.
Yeah.
Especially so, ones based on Toyota's hybrid system.
Yeah. So, and it is, you can tell it's based on Toyota's hybrid system because it's, you just drive and it's like, you know, it's a little loud. But, it, you know, it's still, it's a Crosstrek. It's still a Subaru. You get all-wheel drive. You get that symmetrical all-wheel drive system. It looks fine. That's, you know, the Subaru way. I kind of like the way it looks. I think if, I mean, when the Crosstrek first came out, my whole thing was, why don't you just get an Outback? But sure. The Crosstrek ends up doing pretty well for Subaru. You know, I can understand why. It is like most Subarus, it's a car.
Yeah.
But what, that's a car. What do you?
Yeah, Subaru doesn't make any body on frame stuff.
It's a car. Yeah. What do you do with it? It's a car. It's all the buttons are there. It's these, you know, big giant up and down for your control, your climate controls. It's a car. That's what it does. It does car things. It does it with all wheel drive. It does it with a hatchback, so you can shove a bunch of things in the back. You know, you can fit a bunch of people in there. Well, four, five if you're hella skinny, in the back. Or if you have a tiny baby, I guess.
Or you could fit a couple of dogs.
Couple of dogs, yeah. Yeah, you just put dogs in it. Subaru dogs.
And I believe that Subaru actually, you know, that part of the purchase agreement when you buy a new Subaru is you have to prove that you do have a dog.
Or you're about to get a dog.
Oh, yeah. Have the adoption paperwork ready.
Get or about to take ownership of a dog. I actually, you know, I'm a Subaru fan. You know, it's not fast. It's definitely not the fastest car in the world. Yeah. It is, even with that 194 horsepower, you still, you know, that hybrid system is still like, okay, here we go. it has a 2.5 liter four cylinder, the boxer engine, which, you know, that's a Subaru engine. Just blah, 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 blah.
I like the sound of Subaru boxer engines.
I like the sound of Subaru boxer engines. I used to get, I used to work at a studio in Hollywood, well, Burbank. And so one of the perks of working at a studio is there was a place down the street that would wash your car and do oil changes and do like light maintenance. And they would come into the studio and be like, hey, who wants their car worked on or washed or oil changed or whatever? And you would just give them your keys and they go off and do the thing. Well, everyone else had like boring, like, human cars, and I had my my WRX, my sport wagon, and so they liked it, but they also liked making fun of it because it sounded like a sewing machine.
Yeah,
like, hey, you want your sewing machine done? I'm like, yeah. He's like, all right. So yeah, you know, it's, you know, when you're buying this vehicle, you know, it's 8.7 inches of ground clearance. You probably live in New England or Colorado or parts of Northern California or Tahoe. you know, it has snow mode, has all the bits that you expect from a Subaru. And at the end of the day, it's a Subaru. It's exactly what it is. Yeah, here you go. This is exactly, is it a lot of crazy bells and whistles? Nope. It does have adaptive cruise control, which works fine. Has lane keep assist. Sure. Works fine. All the little extra things work fine. They're not going to have issues with them for the most part. But at the end of the day, it's a Subaru. It's just made to plow through things and take you places. And, you know, you got muddy boots, throw them in the back because we got a big rubber thing in the back. You got some dogs? Awesome. That's the only reason we sold you this car, because you promised us you either had a dog or you would get a dog. Yeah, let's see what else. So the one I got, it starts at $33,995, so $34,000. I guess it's less fun to do the destination delivery. What do you think the destination delivery is?
Ooh, I'm going to say $13.95.
$14.20. So that's pretty close. Yeah. You win. You win no matter what. So yeah, so $35,000, you can get a Crosstrek hybrid. It came in a crystal white pearl, which was like you know they have that cool orange color. What the hell, man? Yeah. why are you specking cars in white? Come on, Subaru. Come on. Is this Aaron's fault?
Well, you know, it's probably somebody said, well, what's the most resale value we can get on this vehicle at the end of its lifespan in the press fleet? And said, yeah. Well, if we get it in white, gray, or black, it'll be better.
But, you know, white's always shooting photos, shooting video with a white car sucks.
Yeah.
That said, yeah, Subaru, 18-inch wheels, lots of, you know, not giant wheels. Some nice sidewall on those wheels for actual driving, and it's comfortable. So,
something that could survive Michigan roads.
Yeah, yeah. That's the whole thing. Is that this car is built to survive?
Yeah, well, yeah. That's always a good start, and it's surprising how far off road something like a Subaru can go. You know, obviously, you know, its ground clearance is about, you know, usually somewhere around 8.5 inches or so. Which is actually pretty good for this type of vehicle, and you know, and it's got surprisingly good traction everywhere, and so you can, you know, you're not going to do the Rubicon Trail in this, but you can go a lot of surprising places with a Subaru.
Yeah, I had I always just put all season. I went snowboarding 25 days a year through like blizzards and stuff. I would get up in the morning like 5 a.m. drive to Tahoe. Snowboard all day and then turn around and drive back through snow, blizzards, whatever. And I did that all in all seasons. Just got the nicest all seasons because I live in the Bay Area. So most of the time, I can't buy winter tires. That'd be ridiculous. And I wasn't going to buy extra tires because I live in an apartment. Zero issues.
Yeah.
Just eats up the mountain. It's just rah, 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 rah. That's what a Subaru does. It just eats up. When you're going up a mountain, you're like, oh, this is why. When you're driving in snow, you're like, oh, this is why people buy the Subaru. This is it. Because it's just, even with the Crosstrek, you're not really that high off the ground. So you feel, you know, you're closer to the ground. So you feel a little, I don't know, being real high off the ground in snow always feels a little wonky to me.
Yeah.
It always feels like this isn't what we should be doing. but yeah, I mean, even the heated set front seats, it has buttons for stuff. There's a lot of buttons.
Yeah. It still has the old Subaru Starlink infotainment system though, right?
Yeah, it still has, which is better than it used to be.
Yeah.
You throw your phone on there.
Yeah, use your CarPlay or Android Auto and you're good.
You know what's absolutely worthless though is the wireless charger. Yeah, because it's just a flat plane, right? And it's underneath in the little cubby below the display. But there's nothing to keep your phone from just sliding all over the place and immediately sliding off the plane.
Yeah.
It's charging when I start it, and then I took a
ride. Modern phones are never completely flat. You know, they've always got some kind of island or bar or something for the cameras.
Which is dumb. Like, who wants – why does my phone need to be thinner than how thick the cameras stick out? Are we sliding phones under doors? Like, what's the point? Just make them all the
same. And even if you are, it's going to get stuck on the camera island anyway.
Yeah, just make it a single plane. Why are we doing this?
Yeah.
What are we? Who are we impressing with us? A phone that's like, let me see, 1 millimeter thinner than it could be.
Some people just want the thinnest thick phone they can possibly get. Hence, but you still have the iPhone Air.
Anyway, Subaru Crosstrek Hybrid 2026. It's a hybrid. You're going to get 36 miles a gallon, apparently, according to the EPA. I'm guessing that's probably on par with what I would get during a drive. I can't 100% say yes, that is, because I haven't done the drive, unfortunately. Yes, it has a CVT. Yes, you're going to notice it. But at the end of the day, you don't care because you bought yourself a Subaru because you just want to drive everywhere and feel comfortable and not have to worry about fancy bells and whistles. It's literally the, like, hey, you want fancy bells and whistles? Yeah, that's not this car. Go buy a Volvo.
Yeah.
But
that Volvo is going to cost you a little bit more than the Subaru.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to cost you more. And, you know, the Crosstrek looks fine. It's a nice looking car.
It's got sufficient bells and whistles.
It has sufficient. It has has all the bits that people want now. Adaptive cruise control, maybe lane keep assist. I don't think I've ever owned a car that had lane keep assist. I didn't turn it off after, you know, an hour. Yes, I tested on the cars. In the real life, I don't know. I don't need this. I don't need something yelling at me because I'm close to the edge of the lane because I'm going around a switchback.
Yeah.
Near my house. I'm like, I don't know. If you're on the freeway though, it's great, I guess. If you're bad at driving.
Yeah.
If you're bad at driving, lane keep assist, your best friend.
Or, you know, I mean, if you've got heavy crosswinds, it can be a little helpful.
Maybe or not. It might be. Yeah, it might not. You know.
Could just be bouncing around in the lane.
Yeah, it could just be. If you're eating a burrito while you're driving, maybe that's kind of helpful.
That's true.
There you go. Burritos. Lane keep assist. Good for burritos.
Or an egg McMuffin and hash browns.
Yeah. 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 Whatever.
Like I did last week.
Yeah. Hamburger.
Yeah.
Hot dog. Two frozen burritos that have been deep fried that you bought in where did I buy those? Wyoming. I ate both of those burritos, by the way, that I bought. I was trying to give one away and I was like, hey, does anyone else want this? And they're like, are you crazy? We're going to be sitting in the car for hours. What's that going to do to my stomach? I'm like, what do you mean? I have an iron stomach, apparently. So I ate my two, if you get, you say, hey, do you want a microwave burrito? I'm like, no, from the store? No. But if they say, hey, do you want a microwave burrito, but we've deep fried it? I'm like, well, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, you deep fry anything, that automatically makes it better.
It does make it better.
Yeah. All right.
Sorry. That was a lot about the Subaru that I didn't really.
No, that's okay. Yeah. That's good. I mean, people need to know. I mean, you know, part of the reason people listen to this, you know, aside from our sparkling conversation, is they want to learn about these cars that they might consider buying sometime. And, you know, so you got to know the important stuff, that you can drive a Subaru Crosstrek Hybrid and eat deep fried frozen burritos.
I did it with the Escalade IQ. You can do it with that's what Lane Keep Assist is for.
Exactly.
To help you eat while you're driving. But please, for the love of God, keep your eyes on the road.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I will say the Escalade IQ, when it was working, the
Super
hands-free, worked fine. Of course, we're in Nebraska. How's it going to go wrong? Like, I could have tied a rope to it and it would have been fine.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what to do with my hand, so I just stuck them on the wheel.
Well, then you need more deep-fried frozen burritos.
Just be like,
Just keep stuffing yourself with burritos for the next 300 miles.
So I try not to get like single serving like plastic drinks, you know, like Diet Coke or water. It was essentially all, but that's all they had. And so with hands free, I could unscrew the cap and then drink my drink and then scrape the cap back on.
That is true.
So that's what hands free is good
for.
So
it has a use.
It has a use.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. We've updated the Wheel Bearings merch store, and now there's a whole bunch of new choices, new colors, new styles, t-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, hats, mugs, travel mugs, stickers, aprons, tote bags, you name it. You can get your Wheel Bearings merch at shop.wheelbearings.media. Go check it out. That's shop.wheelbearings.media. All right. Also spent a lot of time in that Escalade IQ, that very same Escalade IQ, because Cadillac loaned it to us to use for Operation Frodo last week.
Thanks, Cadillac.
And also, you know, Hyundai, Kia, and Lucid also loaned us vehicles.
Yeah, I didn't get to drive the Hyundai. I'm sad about that, but there was,
basically like driving the Kia, but, you know, little nicer interior, you know, little fancier look to it. And a little more range. But the, you know, the Escalade came from the Detroit press fleet, which means we had to get it to Omaha for the start of our trip. And since I live here in the greater Detroit area, I got to drive that vehicle from here to Omaha, which is roughly about 720 miles from my house.
It's a jaunt.
It's a little bit of a jaunt. So I left Friday afternoon and, I stopped just shy of Davenport, Iowa, Friday evening to put some charge in the battery and have some dinner. So, you know, drove across Michigan, drove across Illinois, and Western Illinois just before I crossed the river over to Davenport, I stopped. So I had gone about 370-ish miles at that point. Plugged the car in at an Electrify America station, went across the street to Culver's, had a butter burger, some fries, chocolate shake, and came back. By the time I was done eating, walked back with half my shake. When I arrived, the Escalade was at about 17% charge in it. So that was all, entirely highway driving. And some of it was through some very heavy rain in West Michigan for a couple of hours. And under those conditions, that's kind of the worst case scenario, which we'll talk a little bit more about speed and efficiency in a few minutes. But that's kind of the worst case scenario for range in an EV is highway speeds. Because the Escalade IQ weighs somewhere around 9,000 pounds, it doesn't have an official EPA range rating on it, because anything over 8,500 pounds doesn't get that range rating. So if you look at the Monroney for an Escalade IQ, nothing there. It doesn't say anything for range. But GM in their marketing, they say about 450 miles of range. And that's based on a mix of urban and highway driving. Well, based on the 370-ish miles that I drove, plus what was left in the battery, I would estimate that in highway-only driving, you're probably going to go about 410, 415 miles, which is really, really good. I mean, that's a lot.
Which is so much time on the road.
Yes. That's a long time to be on the road without taking a break and, using the facilities, getting another Red Bull in your case or a cup of tea in my case. I made one stop at Panera to get a cup of tea somewhere in West Michigan and then carried on from there. The next morning, as I was leaving the Days Inn in Walcott, Iowa, which is just west of Davenport, and the Days Inn in Walcott is fine if you just need a place to lay your head down for a few hours.
It's a Days Inn. That's all you really need to say.
I've stayed in a few Days Inns over the year.
So you're a little dazed. You're like, what is happening? Like, you know what? I just need to sleep.
That's the problem. It was spelled with a Z instead of a D-A-Y-S. No wonder.
No, it's like, what's happening? You're like, are they legally allowed to rent this to me?
There's
a shower.
There were no visible bugs, no major stains that I could see. The bed was kind of a little too soft for my tastes, but it was fine. Got up the next morning. There was a McDonald's right next door. Popped in there, grabbed a sausage McMuffin with egg, a couple of hash browns, and a cup of tea, and hit the road towards Omaha. And Super Cruise, really good for eating a sausage McMuffin with egg and a couple of hash browns and sipping on a cup of tea as you're cruising down across Iowa, in this case, which, strangely enough, looks very much like Nebraska and very much like eastern Wyoming.
It's like it's a very step and repeat like part of the country.
It's a rural part of the country. It's mostly farmland. Iowa, actually, I was surprised. I was pleasantly surprised. A lot of wind farms along there, so very good. And then when we got further into Wyoming, saw some more wind farms as well. Not so much in Nebraska, but
which is weird because it's really windy in Nebraska. But you do eat in Nebraska.
So over the course of about 720 miles from my home to the Holiday Inn Express Cherry Hills in Omaha, the Escalade IQ averaged 1.9 miles per kilowatt hour,
which is 19 miles per gallon, but for a vehicle that big and that heavy.
For a 9,000-pound full-size luxury SUV that can carry four dog kennels and three adult human beings full-size adult
it's
human beings.
It's essentially just a giant battery with a Lazy Boy chair in it.
Yeah, or multiple Lazy Boy chairs.
Yeah, with a bunch of Lazy Boy chairs. And then just the rest of it is like, whatever you got, just shove it in here.
Yeah. So, you know, the Escalade is, you know, it is actually a great long-distance road trip vehicle. You know, it's very comfy. The seats have nice massaging functions in them. You know, the air conditioning works well. Over that 720-ish miles, I probably had Super Cruise enabled for about 680 miles of that. One little oddity I did notice from time to time, even going along a dead straight road for hundreds of miles, every once in a while, it would pop up and say, you know, take the wheel, no road information found. It's like, this is a road that is going straight for 100 miles. Suddenly the road information disappears for like 15 seconds. So it would say, take the road, take control, no road information found, put my hands on the wheel. And then, you know, next thing you know, the green light bar is back on and I can take my hands off the wheel again. Very strange. Sometimes, you know, in the maps, you know, there are gaps in the map, you know, for stretches of road, but for so many, just short little stretches seemed a little odd. But other than that, you know, the system worked really well. And, as we get into the next segment, I'll talk a little bit more about where it actually really, really came in handy. But for now, you know, the Escalade IQ has the same dashboard and like 55 inches of display, coast-to-coast display that they have in the Celestiq and their high-end electric luxury sedan. So you've got an instrument cluster display, an infotainment display in the middle, and then there's a passenger display on the right-hand side. And when we were driving on when I was driving with Sebastian on Wednesday, that was the first time I'd been in the passenger seat of the Escalade. So I was messing around with that a little bit, and it's got a filter on there. So when it's on, you know, the passenger can stream video on there, watch stuff, do things with it. I pulled up some YouTube on there, worked fine, and the driver cannot see it. It appears completely black to the driver. I don't know how useful it actually is, you know, because most people have a phone, they have an iPad or a tablet of some sort. So it's not that useful, but it's there if you want to use it. The other thing that was a bit of an annoyance to me is most of the climate controls and the more advanced seat functions and everything are in another touchscreen that is down below the dashboard. It's angled at roughly about a 45 degree angle. So it's much better, much easier to see than the screens in like the Lincoln Navigator and Nautilus, which are almost vertical, but mounted down low at that same height, which, you know, it's just a bad design.
Weird.
But in the Escalade, that screen is angled. So you use that for the climate control. You can also control the climate with your voice. Just say, Hey, G, set the temperature to whatever. The vents are thankfully manual, so you can just reach out and direct the airflow where you want. Very good thing. Good for you, Cadillac. And the massage functions and things like that for the seats and all kinds of other ancillary functions that you don't use very much are through that lower touchscreen. It was a great vehicle to drive, you know, most of the way across the country. About it. Yeah, like I said, lots of room inside. It charges very fast. You know, this thing has this dual layer battery pack. So it's actually like two 100 kilowatt hour battery packs or 105-ish kilowatt hour battery packs. So it's basically the same battery pack that you'll find in a Cadillac Lyriq or a Vistiq or a Chevy Blazer EV. But there's two of them, one stacked on top of the other. And so it's a 400 kilowatt or 400 volt electrical system in the vehicle, but it'll charge on an 800 volt charger, and what it does is it's got a voltage splitter that sends 400 volts to each layer of the battery pack. So it charges, you know, I saw charging as fast as about 360 kilowatts at times. But even when I was charging, you know, when I came back from my dinner, it was at 72% state of charge, 74% state of charge, and it was still going like 170 some kilowatts. So it does charge very fast. That doesn't mean that it doesn't still take a lot of time to charge, just because it's such an enormous battery. But we use that to our advantage, you know, to skip a few charging stops with the Escalade during the rest of the trip. So we just charged the other three, and the Escalade had more than enough to get to the next charging station. The one that I had was the IQ Escalade IQ Premium Sport in Deep Space Metallic, which is a very dark, almost sort of greenish blue. The interior was Harbor Blue, and the grand total price came to $154,495.
That's a lot.
Yeah, you want to take a guess at the destination charge?
$2,200. $2,895. Oh my gosh. Well, it does weigh a lot.
Yeah, 9,000 pounds.
Yeah. My man, that's, I mean, well, yeah. There you go.
Yeah. So this one, yeah, it had a few options. Had the rear seat entertainment system. So you get in the second row, you get screens on the back of the front seats and wireless headphones. AKG, Bluetooth wireless headphones. The rear entertainment system was $2,000. The headphones were another $400. It did come with an AUX adapter, which I did not actually have to use on this trip. It also had $725 for the. For the paint, the deep space metallic paint. That is the Escalade IQ. We talked last week a lot about Operation Frodo, but there's one more thing I want to discuss related to Frodo, which is just overall efficiency. You know, when I was planning out the route for this trip and planning, you know, where we're going to do charging stops, you know, knowing which vehicles we had the Escalade, we had Lucid Gravity, the Kia EV9, and a Hyundai Ioniq 9. And, the EV9 and Ioniq 9, particularly the EV9, had the shortest range of the four. So it's rated at about 280 miles of range for the GT line that we had. And, you know, as I said, highway driving is kind of the worst case scenario, because as your speed increases, the aerodynamic drag force goes up. The drag force goes up. That's squared as your speed. So if you double your speed, your drag force goes up by a factor of four. And that makes a big difference, especially as you get to higher and higher speeds. So if you drive an EV, I mean, actually the same thing is true if you drive a gas or a diesel vehicle. If you go from 65 to 70 to 75 to 80 miles an hour, you will see a significant drop in efficiency. You'll see a lot more fuel consumption with a combustion vehicle, and you'll see a lot more battery energy consumption with an EV. And through large portions of this trip, going down, especially going across western Nebraska and into Wyoming and also in Idaho, it's speed limits of 80 miles an hour on the highway. And, you know, I encouraged everyone to try to keep the speeds to about 75 or below, but it's hard to do that when the speed limit is 80. And so we managed to get through the first 2 days of the trip with two charging stops a day and then charging in the evening. And that worked out fine. And those are the longer legs of the trip. But when we got to Idaho, leaving Salt Lake City and going up, driving northwest into Idaho, and then on into Oregon, we had a lot more elevation change, a lot more climbing, and also a lot more wind. And so based on what we saw the first couple of days, I added an extra charging stop on each of those first 2 days as we were doing the mountain climbs. And that worked out fine, especially on the day three, going from Salt Lake City to Ontario, Oregon. When we got to day four, I added a stop in between Ontario and Stanfield, Oregon. And when we got to Stanfield, which was scheduled to be our last stop, at that point we had 186 miles to go. And we were not far from descending down into the Columbia River Gorge. So we had passed the peak elevation. We weren't going to be doing much more climbing, but so we'd be going downhill. So I figured, okay, we should be good with 186 miles and pretty much a full charge on all these things, or most of a charge on these things, because we're going downhill, get some regen, you know, certainly less energy to go downhill than to go uphill. And boy, was I wrong.
Oh, no.
So we left the Stanfield Charger. And I was driving the Escalade. We had 54% state of charge. It was showing 245 miles of range. We had 186 miles to go. And Google Maps was estimating we'd arrive with 15% state of charge. As we finished the last little bit of the climb and then going down the Columbia River, the winds coming up the Columbia River Gorge were just, it was like 40-mile-an-hour winds going in the opposite direction that we were. So it was effectively like going 40 miles an hour faster. And that gap between estimated range and how far we had to go kept shrinking and shrinking, going from like 60 miles and eventually got down to 20 miles and was showing only 7% state of charge on arrival. And that was when we were only about a third of the way along that distance. And figured, okay, we're definitely going to have to stop somewhere. And fortunately, part of the reason, you know, why we opted to do this trip is, you know, when I did the research, I figured, oh, there's actually a lot of charging stations that we could use. So we never had an issue with anybody running out of charge and getting stranded. There was always someplace to stop. But, I was hoping to not have a stop on that last leg because we were trying to get to Portland by about 2 p.m. to meet up with the crew from Cascade Beagle Rescue and Seattle Beagle Rescue, who were going to be taking the dogs and some of the adoptive families for the dogs. And as we're going down, the Interstate 84, which goes along the Columbia River, the speed limit along there was 65. I came up on a FedEx truck that was going like 67, 68 miles an hour. It's like, yes, tuck in behind that guy. Makes a nice big hole in the air for the Escalade, which is a very large vehicle, and just set the Super Cruise and just stayed on his tail for the next 70 miles. And that gap between range and distance started growing again. And he finally pulled off the highway about just outside of Portland. And we got to our destination with 10% state of charge and 46 miles of range left, which was perfect.
The moral of the story is find a FedEx truck.
Yes. Yeah. Find a big truck to coast behind.
And then if you're flying into some crazy headwinds.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, last year when I was coming back from Japan, from the Japan Mobility Show, flying out of Tokyo, for the first 4 or 5 hours of the trip, we had something like 170-mile-an-hour tailwind, I mean.
Ooh.
Which meant that we arrived back in Detroit an hour and a half early. Because we were, the cruising speed for an Airbus A350 is about 580 miles an hour. We had a ground speed of 760 miles an hour.
Wow.
Yeah.
Doing pretty good. Wind's crazy.
Yeah.
So while you were talking, I was looking at the map. I was just, like, following along.
So, yeah. So the moral of the story, such as it is, you don't have to drive at, maximum speed. If you just keep your speed down a little bit, you will actually be able to go a lot farther on a charge. The faster you go, every additional mile per hour is going to have a disproportionate impact on your available range and your energy efficiency. So just slow down a few miles an hour. Go 75 instead of 80 if you can. You know, go 70 instead of 75 if you can. Because you'll go a lot farther.
Yeah. And same with gas.
Yeah. Absolutely same thing is true. You know, your fuel economy. Yeah. When we were doing Operation Frodo in December, one of the vehicles we had was an Ineos Grenadier. And especially driving across Wyoming and Idaho, that thing had, it was averaging like 12 miles per gallon. Because, you know, it doesn't get great fuel economy to begin
it's
with.
It's just a flat brick.
Yeah. It's only rated at about 16. But with those winds in that region, the headwinds in that region, it really hit the fuel economy hard. So.
Yeah.
But at the end of the trip, I think the overall, I've got it here somewhere, the overall efficiency for the Escalade when we arrived in Portland was about 2 miles per kilowatt hour, which is not bad. Yeah. In Stanfield, we were at 2,200 miles, or somewhere in Oregon, we were at 2,200 miles, and we were 1.8 miles per kilowatt hour total, and we managed to get that up to almost 2 miles per gallon, or 2 miles per kilowatt hour by the time we arrived. Ooh. So.
Thanks, FedEx truck.
All right. So, one of the reasons why you did not, were not able to stick around for the whole trip was because you had to go to San Francisco on Tuesday for a GM event.
Yeah. So I went to the GM Empower. That's a weird, sure. So I went to that event. And it was interesting. There's some of it was like, okay, but the app that you put all the chargers in was one of their big pieces of news. I'm like, well, that's, sure. but the V2G news was good. It was expected. GM Energy has a charging, it's a bi-directional charging system. You can set up, you can get a battery pack, you can add it to your solar, and of course you can use your vehicle to charge your home. What it didn't have originally up until this event was V2G, which is vehicle to grid. And now that's the whole system supports V2G to the grid, so all the vehicles that are out that support V2G, V2X now support V2G. So essentially, your car with this system can be used to power the grid, and, you know, maybe you can make some money. You know, all this depends on individual utility companies. They're working with a PG&E here in California. And then I forget the name of the Detroit one.
DTE Energy.
DT. I guess that sounds like pretty easy to remember. I don't know how I forgot that. So DTE Energy in Detroit. And again, the idea is like, you could help balance the grid. Your car is just sitting there most of the time. If you're like me and you work from home, if you're, maybe my car's just sitting at home all day. If you're at home, if you work a regular 9-to-5, you get home at 6 o'clock, you plug your car in. They could use your car. That's peak hours, from like 3 to 9.
Yeah, that evening period. Yeah, from like 3 to 7 or something usually.
So you could set your car to say, hey, I'll allow the grid to use up to use my vehicle until it hits about 20% of charge. And then in the middle of the night, when it's nice and cheap to charge your vehicle, you can recharge your vehicle. So you can make a little money. You can help balance the grid. They talked a lot about AI, which is funny because for years I've had to push back on the EVs are going to, destroy the grid. They're going to bring the grid down. I'm like, well, first of all, not everyone doesn't come home and plug in their cars and start charging at the exact same time. Like, that's not how that works.
Yeah.
Especially if you're thinking, well, I want to save some money because I paid a premium for an EV. I'm going to plug my car in and have it scheduled to charge in the middle of the night when everyone's asleep. Sure, if you're crazy and you're full of cash, you're going to come home and plug your car in at 6 o'clock and let it charge then. Sure, fine. And again, you don't have to most new cars, you don't have to charge every day. And if you have an e-Golf, yeah. If, you know, you're probably going to charge that every day. But if you have, you know, we don't charge our...
We charge our EV6 once, twice a week.
Yeah, exactly. That's the same thing with our Ioniq 5. You know, I think most EV people are like, well, if I don't have to plug it in, I'm not going to. And then, you know, it gets under 40% or whatever. I guess I should plug in my car is essentially how it works. The reality is that AI, which is being used all the time, anytime someone's on a computer, you know, there's a potential for them to use AI. AI uses a ton of energy, like just a metric ton of energy. And they were, you know, GM and PG&E were both like, AI's happening. We can use these cars to help balance the grid, to help, you know, balance the hit that AI data centers are going to be pushing onto the grid, which is, again, I've been telling people for years, I'm like, you know, your car could charge your house. Your car could be part of the grid. The problem is that there's standardization for that has become, you know, it's there is a IEEE standard that came out last April. Yeah, I think that's right. Mm-hmm. It's the plug and charge standard. Well, that now supports bidirectional charging. The problem is getting everyone to do it. So it's not just the automakers. You have to have the automakers. Then you have to have someone who builds the charging station, which is at this point is usually the automakers, unless you're like Kia. They're using Wallbox, and you have to like get the on board.
The automakers usually outsource the charging station manufacturing to companies like Delta Electronics. Like GM uses Delta Electronics for theirs.
So you have to sort of get all these different players to support vehicle to grid. GM has it. They're like, hey, we have it. You can use it. It only works with GM vehicles. I can't plug my Hyundai into it and do V to G. I can't plug a Ford into it. I can't plug a Lucid into it. I can't plug anything else into it. Only GM vehicles. I talk to them and they give me the same answer they give me every time. We're like, well, you know, this is a value proposition for GM owners, blah, blah, blah. But we would happily support, you know, once it's everyone. The problem, though, is still like, you know, it's not universal. It's not, you know, there's no standard everyone can agree on. That also requires utilities and like, you know, like there's, you know, a couple dozen automakers. There's hundreds of utility companies.
There's over 3,000 utilities in the United States.
Yeah. So there's a lot. So, you know, so.
And they all have different standards.
Yeah. They're all going to have different standards. The larger ones, you know, like PG&E, Southern California Edison, et cetera, Con Ed,
New York.
Yeah, like all these bigger ones, yeah, that's going to be a lot easier for them to sort of do it if they want to. And that's the other thing. Do they want to do this? Is it worth their time? Do they think it's worth their effort? PG&E seems to think it is. So if you have a GM vehicle in the Bay Area or Northern California or central to Northern California where PG&E sort of runs the power here, then you could make this a reality. That's great. It's one step closer to more and more vehicles having this. It's one step closer to using the full potential of electric vehicles in order to sort of balance the grid. It's weird. Again, it's also funny that it's the idea that, well, EVs are going to destroy the grid, and now it's like no, hold on. They're an additional energy source in order to save the grid. So that's cool. And then they also, they have our little thing. PG&E.
Well, one more thing on the V to G. GM said that working with PG&E, they're targeting having over 50,000 homes in the Bay Area set up with V to G by 2030.
Yeah, that was, I just found that thing. So 52, that's a lot of homes. One of the things I learned I think last year or year before is that there's more people with houses than rent. More people own than rent in this country, which it still kind of boggles my mind. I don't know how that's true, but sure. So I guess more people have the potential for doing this. They also showed off in collaboration partnership with Peak Energy they didn't show it off. It's, you know, they talked about it. It's a sodium ion.
They have a picture of it, a rendering or a picture of probably, you know, at least a mock-up, if not a prototype.
It's a, yeah, it's a mock-up. Yeah. Sodium ion batteries, which they're built, which they want to manufacture and source for energy storage. So, you know, the energy store, you know, the, all those the energy storage systems, you'll see ESS used more and more often. If you see that, that's energy storage system. And it's essentially storage for the grid. So you have, you know, the, one of the fun things is people like whenever you talk about solar or wind, they're like, what happens when the sun's down? I'm like, well, yeah, but when it's up, it's free electricity.
Yeah. And we actually, you know, most of the solar facilities that we have already are capable of producing more electricity during daytime hours than can be used during that period. So, you know, that the challenge is, okay, you know, so how do we grab that electricity from the sun and make it available the rest of the, you know, during the night? And that's where energy storage comes in.
Dun, dun, dun. So that's when people say, well, what happens when the sun goes down? They're like, well, all the extra energy that the sun is making gets put into a battery and then
or
in the
wind.
Middle of the night. Or wind,
yeah.
And then when it's not sunny, you know, nighttime, use the storage out of those battery packs. And you know, what's funny is I knew people in the 80s who were doing this with like sort of the off the grid sort of people. I'm from a small town again. So they had like solar and they had a generator and then but they also had batteries and, you know, at night they would turn off things and it would just be the you know, they'd just be running off, the power in their batteries. And these were like marine lead acid batteries, like just had like them all running in parallel.
Probably series. A combination of parallel and series, but
yeah. Which when I said series, my phone went crazy. but yeah, so that, you know, they're, you know, so Peak Energy already has a sodium ion battery pack out in an ESS, out in storage systems. GM says that their version of that, what they're working, what they're developing is they're like, this is like generation two. Imagine that's gen one. This is gen two. The idea being these are going to be far more, you know, energy dense. They would tell us what the energy density was. They wouldn't tell us what the price per like kilowatt was, price per module was. They did say that the operating cost would be 20% lower than what people are using now because sodium ion doesn't need to be cooled because it works at up to 140 degrees, between negative 40 and like, I think 141. Yeah.
Yeah. I talked with Kurt Kelty, who's the head of batteries and electrification at GM, the week before the Empower event, before we went out on the trip. And, you know, one of the things he highlighted, you know, sodium ion batteries, you know, they're actually already in production in China. They're already using them. But you know, the beauty of sodium ion batteries, it's basically salt. You're using salt, just a lot of salt in the world, and pretty easy to process. And the sodium ion batteries have lower energy density than what you get from nickel-rich lithium ion or lithium iron phosphate batteries, which makes them less suitable for EVs, but because the cost is so much lower and it, you know, we can process everything here, we don't have to worry about getting processed materials from other parts of the world. They can manufacture them and they're very stable. Like you said, they don't need the active cooling. So an energy storage system, unlike a vehicle, you know, which, you know, might have, say, a 3,000-pound battery that you have to haul around everywhere, you know, and you, in a vehicle, you want your battery to be smaller and lighter because it makes the vehicle more efficient. For a stationary energy storage system, you don't really care because that battery's not going anywhere. So you can use a lower energy density battery, and sodium ion works great for that. And so that's what they're going to start doing at some point in the coming years. You know, they didn't talk about it, any date or anything like that, but
they told me they would like production 2028.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's something that they're working on. You know, the car battery is a very specialized battery, like you were saying, and you know, the discharge, you know, the operating environment of a EV battery is bonkers. Uh-huh. It's like, it's got to discharge, it's got to discharge, you got to charge, you got to discharge, like at really quick rates in order for you to have and it has to be efficient and they're trying to make it as light as possible. And, you know, and all the things you have to deal with. You don't have to worry about this with sodium, with these ESS batteries because they don't need to charge and discharge at like 230 kilowatts. You know, they don't, So you just need to, like, okay, we have a bunch of them. All right, we need more energy. Okay, here we go. Here's some energy. All right, now let's just charge it up. All right, now here's some energy. And it, the and these batteries should have a much longer cycle than your car battery. My article,
yeah, I think you said close to 100,000 charge cycles.
Yeah, it's a lot of charge cycles, which is more than you're ever gonna. If you had a car, that's a lot of. If you charge every single day,
that's millions of miles of driving, equivalent of millions of miles of driving, and frankly, most of the mechanical parts of your car are going to be worn out long before you would wear out one of these batteries.
So it would be two. If you charge it and discharge your car every day, it's 273.8 years, 100,000 cycles. Obviously, these will, they'll charge and discharge throughout the day. That's one of the things. But even then, you're just like, that's a long time.
Yeah. But
so,
that's not all GM's doing with energy storage, though, because, they're also starting to produce lithium iron phosphate cells at their Spring Hill, Tennessee plant. But they're, again, not for vehicles. They're using LFP cells in the new Chevy Bolt. But they're making the LFP cells they're making in Spring Hill, they are actually selling those back to LG to put into energy storage systems, because LG is already making those same cells at their plant here in Holland, Michigan. And now Spring Hill, Tennessee is also going to supply those to LG. And LG is building the energy storage systems and selling them to data centers and factories and stuff. And they're also partnering with Redwood Materials, who is best known up till now mainly for recycling lithium-ion batteries. But they've also developed a system to repurpose used EV batteries. And GM is partnering with Redwood to use the old Chevy Bolt batteries. Remember when they had the recall on all the Bolts to replace the batteries? Well, all those batteries that came out of Chevy Bolts a couple of years ago, they all got sent to a place in Oklahoma City, owned by Cox Automotive, where they've been remanufacturing those batteries. They test them all, and then they went through and tested them and replaced bad cells and modules in those battery packs, and made those available as refurbished batteries, for service parts. But now they've got a whole bunch of surplus of that they Redwood is going to, or using Redwood's process, they're going to turn those into energy storage for GM facilities. So they're building up about 100 energy storage systems Redwood is going to deploy about 100 of these battery packs at one of their plants at one of the GM plants in Michigan to provide 1.5 megawatts and 7.2 megawatt hours of energy storage, and then expand and do additional ones from that until they use up all these battery packs. So that's pretty cool too. And actually GM has a long history of using these second life battery packs, because back in the early 2010s, all the battery packs that they had from all the original Chevy Volt development vehicles, when those vehicles were scrapped, they took out the battery packs, and they it was a smaller scale one, but they made an energy storage system out of those Volt battery packs at the Milford Proving Grounds to support their IT facilities there. So they're doing some interesting stuff with the batteries.
Yeah, no, it's I did an article with the battery magazine that I run for SAE. So the battery magazine doesn't have, we don't put these as online articles, but I'll send you the thing talking about how Redwood Materials, they're sort of recycling, how they do this safely, how they they get these batteries, these batteries that weren't. That they have come out of other vehicles and test them, and how they monitor them. It's pretty interesting. I'll send you that you can drop in the show notes and stuff. But yeah, it's a lot of stuff. It's not. I don't think for the average person, it doesn't seem that necessarily that exciting. But at the end of the day, if if a car can make your energy bill, you know, less than that's great. Even if it's not your car,
yeah.
Someone else's car is keeping you from having a brownout.
Yeah, I mean, if it's supporting the overall grid, and especially as they keep building all these data centers, you know, that's putting more and more strain on the grid. If we can support the grid using the EVs that we drive, then that is potentially some less infrastructure that utilities like PG&E and DTE have to build up as new stuff.
Yeah. There's this thing called peakers, which are part of the grid, and they're usually they fire them up when the grid needs, you know, more electricity, uh-huh. And typically they're pretty bad.
Yeah.
Because A, it costs a lot of money. B, they're usually not great for the environment. They run, you know, diesel, coal, polar bears, penguins. You know, whenever something's cute, that's what they use to fire it up with. They just toss it into the. But yeah, peakers. And if you can replace a peaker with batteries and batteries that are in cars that are already out on the road, that's going to be great. That allows you to sort of A, not deal with those peakers, which again they're expensive to spin up, because hey, you got to put people there, you got to turn it on, you got to get it ready, you got to, and then now you have like almost a gross polluting addition to the grid in order to keep the grid from collapsing upon itself. So if you can say, hey, instead of that, why don't we use all these cars that are plugged in, and these people have said, yeah, that's cool, you can use my car, then yeah, it's a smarter way to do.
Okay. I think that's pretty much everything they announced at Empower.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go to BMW. So this weekend was the 24-hour Le Mans in France. And oftentimes some manufacturers that are involved in endurance racing will make some product announcements in the run-up to the big race. And you know, as we're recording this, the race is over. I'm not going to tell you who won, just in case you're, you know, watching it on a, you know, watching a recording of it and you don't want to be spoiled.
Maybe you TiVo'd it. But, TiVo. Remember TiVo?
I never had a TiVo.
I did. I loved my TiVo.
We had a Comcast DVR for a number of years until we finally ditched Comcast, but never had a TiVo. So anyway, both BMW and Genesis, both of whom, you know, were racing this weekend, announced they showed some concepts that at least one of which is probably extremely close to a very near future production vehicle, and that's BMW. BMW had the M Concept Neue Klasse. So we've seen the new i3, which is their electric sedan, the 3 Series size sedan. We've over the last year or so, we've seen spy photos of the next generation M3, an electric M3. So now they're basically showing that electric M3 as a concept. This thing is something.
I like it.
Yeah. It has, where's the number here? It's got a lot of power.
Well, it is an M, so that's his job.
They don't actually say in the press release, but it's a high performance, a much higher performance version of what we'll see with the i3. It's got flared out fenders and, it's got all kinds of other cool stuff on it. And this will probably hit production sometime later in 2027. So it's using the Neue Klasse's 6th-gen EV hardware that's in the other Neue Klasse models, 800-volt architecture, a battery with more than 100 kilowatt hours. It'll probably get somewhere in the neighborhood of 700 or 800 horsepower, I'm guessing.
It'll be fine.
Yeah. It will be
800 volt. It's got a 100 kilowatt hour battery pack. So it's going to, you know, it's like, oh, you can go really far, which you could, But it's an M, so you'll probably be going like three quarters of that because you're driving like a maniac.
Yeah. And, you know, it's capable of going at speeds that will severely reduce your overall energy efficiency.
100 kilowatt. Yeah. No, it's really cool. It'll be fun to see what it looks like when it comes out. It'll probably look pretty close to this. But it'll be even funner to drive it when it's available.
And then Genesis, which had their debut at Le Mans this weekend, with their hypercar, they introduced the Magma GT3 concept. So, you know, in World Endurance Championship, they have two classes of cars. They have the prototypes, the hypercar prototypes, and they have GT cars, which are nominally based on road cars. You know, so you find cars like Corvettes, C8 Corvettes, and AMG GTs, and Mustang GT3s, you know, which are very look like a Mustang, you know, and there's 911s and Ferrari 296s. Well, it looks like Genesis kind of did work backwards, because usually for GT3, the idea is manufacturers are supposed to take a production car and then develop that into a race car. It looks like AMG or Genesis basically went the opposite way, designed a race car to GT3 rules, and then are doing a production version of that. And so that's what this GT3 concept looks like. It, you know, they don't give any real technical details on it, but it looks, you know, it appears to be a mid-engine two-seat sports car which reportedly will use the new 3.2-liter V8 that they use in the GMR 001 hypercar, the prototype, which is a purebred racing engine. Did you see the picture of the shifter in here?
Oh, I mean, keep clicking around.
It looks like a classic, you know, Ferrari or Lamborghini gated shifter.
Oh, yeah, gated shifter.
Except, you know, it's like modern performance cars, you know, this is going to be, you know, some sort of paddle shift system. So you've got a gate that goes between park, reverse, drive, and then on the far right, you have a toggle to go forward and back. But, you know, most of the people driving this, you know, if they're going to shift it, they're just going to use the paddles on the steering wheel.
Cool.
And yeah, you know, this is probably going to be a fairly pricey car when they build it. But it'll allow Genesis to run this in the GT3 class, which is a popular sports car racing class globally. You know, there's GT3 series all over the world. They run them here in North America in IMSA. They have the European Le Mans Championship, the Asian Le Mans Championship. SRO has a bunch of series around the world. So this is one of the most popular racing series globally. So I suspect that probably by 2028, we will see a Genesis Magma GT running globally.
Cool.
All right. And then Audi had a bunch of stuff recently. They showed off, first of all, you know, they revealed the third generation Q7 this week. So it's basically, you know, they're three row combustion crossover. And it's going to have a variety of powertrains. So there's a Q7 and the higher performance SQ7. The SQ7 gets a 4-liter twin turbo V8, 591 horsepower, 590 foot pounds of torque. 0 to 60 in 3.7 seconds. And then the standard Q7 is a 2.9-liter twin-turbo V6, 429 horsepower, 442 pounds-feet of torque, 0 to 60, and a more leisurely 4.8 seconds.
Yeah, leisurely.
Yeah. It's going to have a hybrid system on there. Although it doesn't say anything in the U.S. press release about that, but I did, at least in Europe, it's going to have a hybrid version. It might not for the North American model, because I'm looking at the U.S. press release and it doesn't say anything about the hybrid. But, you know, it's similar in size to the current Q7, which is, you know, and I think it's a better looking vehicle than the current generation Q7. I was never particularly enamored with that one. But yeah. As is usually the case these days, especially for premium vehicles like this, lots of screen, you know, big giant instrument cluster screen, infotainment screen, and then a passenger screen on the far right.
Someday, America's going to care about those screens.
And then Audi also showed the new Nuvolari concept. So, you know, they discontinued the R8 a couple of years back. Didn't give any indication whether it would get a replacement. There was some speculation that there might eventually be an all-electric replacement. But now they've decided to go a different direction. And this one has, you know, it's 1,001 horsepower. Because, you know, 1,000 horsepower, even 1,000 horsepower would simply not be enough. So you got 1,001. 350 kilometer per hour top speed. And it's a twin turbo 4-liter V8 with a plug-in hybrid and three electric motors. Basically, this is a rebodied version of the new Lamborghini Temerario.
Yeah. It's like Art Deco. You want a Lamborghini? There you go.
Yeah. It's an interesting design. I don't know how crazy I am about the front end of it.
I like Art Deco, so.
Yeah.
There you go.
I like Art Deco buildings. Yeah. I'm not so sure about Art Deco cars.
You don't like Art Deco cars? Oh, all right. That's fine.
But, yeah, so the Nuvolari, I would guess, you know, that this will probably appear by about 2028, if not sooner.
Yeah, probably a little toned down, just a scooch from this.
Yeah.
Just a little. Does it have side mirror? It has side mirrors, so they're done. Let's be honest. Actually, when I'm looking at it, I'm like, you know what? That's done. This is what we're getting.
It's got everything we need.
Yeah.
It's got a grill, got side mirrors, got seat belts and everything. I mean, it looks fairly complete. So, I mean, we could see it as early as 2027.
Yeah.
All right. And then they also had an announcement about the upcoming Q9, which is even larger than the Q7. I actually saw a Q9 prototype when I was in Denver a couple of months ago. It was all camouflaged and was driving around. But one of the things on the Q9 is it's going to be Audi's first U.S. market car with digital matrix LED headlights.
Dun, dun, dun.
So, you know, they've had these dynamic headlights in Europe for a long time, and they finally changed the regulations here in the U.S. a couple of years ago to allow these things. So, you know,
well, not as good as the European ones. This is why you can't.
True.
Yeah, that's the issue is they had to create, like, before they would always say, as soon as the regulations, we can just, this is a software issue.
Yeah.
We can just, you know, we can just turn the hardware on here in the United States. And then the rule came out and they're like, oh.
Yeah. Because they had the hardware on the U.S. market cars. They just couldn't, they weren't allowed to behave in the dynamic way. They just had to behave like normal headlights.
Yeah,
which didn't really help anybody. So you've driven cars with you know, these dynamic headlights, right?
Yep.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Crazy.
It masks
out people coming at you.
Yeah.
So you can still have your high beams on, but the person driving towards you doesn't get blinded.
Yeah.
They just,
as far as they're concerned, you're just driving with low beams.
Exactly. So it's actually quite, it's good for everyone, to be honest.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous it took so long. What is it? They've had these in Europe since 2013.
Yeah. Well, this one on the Q9 is a new generation that's using micro LEDs for the lighting. But I drove the second generation Rivian R1S. That one had was one of the first U.S. market cars to have these kinds of headlights. I don't think they're micro LEDs on the Rivian, but you know, I was driving down a rural road one night, and you know, it had the high beams on. And then as soon as a car was coming towards us, I just see this little cutout in the light pattern where it went to low beams right around that car, and everything around it was still lit up, which is really, really neat.
Yeah.
So you can still see when a deer runs out in front of you. All right, Subaru, also in Japan this week, teased three new models coming next year, all available with manual transmissions.
Dun, dun, dun.
And
well,
among
two
those,
of them were like, well, duh.
Yeah. Among these is a new WRX STI.
Yay.
So there's a WRX STI. There is a an updated BRZ based on the STI Sport Type RA that they launched in Japan. That one, they were only making 300 units of those. And only for the Japan market. So it's got ZF dampers, Brembo brakes, improved aero. So they're doing a version of that, which is apparently going to be for global markets. And then there is also going to be a new Impreza hatchback with a manual transmission. So you will be able to get, you know, basically like a Crosstrek type vehicle with a manual transmission.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe in the United States. Maybe.
Yeah, we'll see if they actually sell all of them here in the U.S.
Yeah. I like the Impreza idea because it's just like, oh, you want a pretty cool, okay car, but now it's a lot more fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it just makes the Impreza about 10 times better as far as I'm concerned, throwing a manual transmission in it.
And then there's one last item. Father's Day is coming up next Sunday. So Dodge has got a gift for the fathers in your life, or maybe, yeah, maybe, I don't know. I don't know who would want to give this to their father.
There's some people who would.
Yeah.
The Mopar no car people.
Yeah. They have come up with a Dodge Charger fragrance. And the headline on the press release is, "One spray will have Dad firing on all cylinders."
Sure.
Yeah. I don't even want to imagine what this stuff smells like. It was like I was saying earlier, it's probably a combination of Axe, gasoline, and burnt rubber.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a Dodge Charger fragrance. I'm like, oh, yeah. I think it's, you know, it'll be a. It's one step away from a gag gift.
Yeah.
For most people, I think it's going to be a gag gift. For some dads, it's going to be like, this is the greatest thing you've ever purchased me. I now love you, son and or daughter.
Yeah. If your father, you know, has a Charger, Challenger, Hellcat, you know, and loves that car and wouldn't give it up for the world, get them some of the Dodge Charger fragrance. They will probably like it.
It doesn't come with the it's $25. Oh, okay, so the top notes are bergamot, I don't know what that is, mandarin and orange. The mid notes are black pepper, sage, and jasmine. And then the base notes are cedarwood, patchouli, and amber. You lost me at patchouli. Hippies. Black pepper. Yeah, so your car smells, so your dad's going to smell like a baked potato. All the bits you put on a baked potato.
I'm sure your dad will love it. But if my kids are listening, and I'm pretty sure they're not, please don't get me this.
I'm going to get this for my dad. He doesn't really care about cars, to be honest. He knows how to work on anything, doesn't care about cars. He knows he cares that it gets him where he needs to go. That's all he cares about.
All right. And then finally, we had one email from Mark in Chicago. This is also a Frodo-related query. Mark,
all Frodo all the time.
Yeah, Mark wanted, don't worry, after today we won't be talking about Frodo again for a while.
I'm going to talk about Frodo forever.
Okay. Mark says, I have a quick question. Is Frodo only open to journalists, or can normal human volunteers drive? My wife and I are huge dog rescue supporters here in Chicago. Although our work schedule won't allow it, I'd be more than happy to be a volunteer driver. Having just taken delivery of a new 26 Ridgeline, I'd be able to help out as a support vehicle and carry supplies. I could also have dog crates in the back seat. Realize it's too late for this year. But I'm retired and thinking ahead to next year. Greatly enjoy your podcast and look forward to each episode. So Mark, and to everyone else, it's not, you know, I mean, it started off, you know, just as people from automotive media, but, you know, on this particular trip, We did have someone who volunteered. And, you know, we were looking for one additional driver, and Nick Miles, who started this whole thing, put out a post on in a group on Facebook, and we had Michelle join us. You know, she's never done anything like this before, so there is potential to bring in outsiders if you're interested. Mark, I will put your name on the list. We will be doing another trip in December. That one will be a non-EV trip again, although we'll probably have some hybrids in there. I'll put your name on the list, and you know, we'll see how things work out. And if, you know, for everyone else, you know, even if you're not participating specifically in Operation Frodo, there are lots of opportunities to work with your local shelters, local rescue organizations, not just with dogs, but with other animals as well. You know, if you're interested in helping out, you know, find your local Humane Society, SPCA, you know, dog rescues, you know, for all different kinds of breeds, cat rescues, you know, and other animals, and, you know, do some volunteer work with them. You know, I mean, shelters usually need people to, you know, just spend some time with the animals, you know, go walk the dogs, you know, spend some time with the cats, you know, so they're not just isolated by themselves in the shelters. They often need foster parents, you know, because a lot of shelters are overcrowded. There's some dogs that just, or some animals that just don't do well in a direct shelter environment. You know, they may be skittish, afraid of other animals, because they've been mistreated or whatever. So, you know, oftentimes, you know, they're looking for fosters to look, you know, to care for these animals at home, in their homes, temporarily until, you know, adoptive families can be found. So there's lots of opportunities to participate, you know, to help out animals. So, you know, reach out to us, you know, if you're interested in participating in Frodo, and we'll see if we can get you in. But also, you know, reach out to your local organizations and see what they need, what kind of help they need.
Yeah, you can, you know, it's money. That's the other thing. You'd be like, "Well, I don't have time. I don't have, like, you know." You can send a little bit of money goes a long way. Some of these places usually have. It's like, I always talk to people like food banks. They're like, "Oh, I'm going to take them food." I'm like, "Don't take them food. Take them money.
Yeah,
give them money, because they typically can get stuff at a better rate than, you know, your old can of peas. They can get, like, you know, if you give them the money that you spend on your old can of peas, they could probably buy three cans of peas. So
right, and you know, nonprofits, you know, usually, you know, they get exempted from things like sales taxes and so on, so they can get more from the same amount of money if you just give them cash. But reach out, see what they need. You know, sometimes they need materials, they need cash, and they need volunteers. So, you know, help out in any way you can.
Yeah.
All right. And that's it for this week. And I think Nicole will be back next Sunday with us. So thanks all for listening, and we will talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye.